manuscript, a rich and full and complete version of the book of the coming forth by day. Here we find the priest Ani pictured at the beginning of the scroll. But he has died. Therefore, we find the inscription reading, Osiris, who was Ani. Now, this occurs frequently in the manuscript, or the reverse formula, Ani, who is Osiris. Thus, we have an identification that is very important, namely that at death, the soul of man becomes God. Now, where would this have come from? There is only one possible answer that we have at the present time, and that would be Middle Ages. For here we would find that perhaps at the same time that we are concerned with, the idea that the Atman, or supreme power of the universe, existed in all things, and that the spirit or life in every living thing is God. And that when the body is removed, or being departs from the body, it is in one way or another hallowed or glorified. We know that the time of the papyrus of Ani, therefore, that the soul or spiritual content within the nature of Ani was Osiris. That all souls passing out of the body were Osirified. That is, they became one with Osiris. They were restored again to him. Egyptian metaphysics seems to point out, therefore, that in a mysterious way, Osiris is the world soul. We have already mentioned that he was not the supreme deity, because he was the lord of the underworld. And this would be perfectly consistent with the idea of the world psyche being the lord of the mortal world. And that in the soul experience of living things, the souls of all separate beings are ultimately restored to the world soul. And that therefore Osiris is the shepherd of souls, and that the place of peace or of survival, representing either the paradise to come or the assembly of the initiates in this world, was properly denominated the sheepfold, or the place for the gathering of the sheep. So we have now this concept also added, that in each human being there is an Osiris. That this Osiris perhaps therefore can be compared to Paul's ecstatic utterance that Christ is you, the hope of glory. This idea of the indwelling divinity is rather unique for its period in the doctrine of the Middle Egyptians. The next point that we find, in the eschatology of the situation, is the description of the world in which Osiris rules. He rules in a wonderful temple located in the other where, not here, but somewhere else. He rules, therefore, in a temple beyond the common dimensions of our concept. This temple is, according to some report, standing in the midst of the underworld, in the world of dreams, in the world of the subconsciousness of things. But it is this otherworldness in which it exists, this otherworldness to which all must come by the mystery of death, and the otherworldness from which all things came in the mystery of birth. So we now have a world and another world. And this one world that we see and in which we live and move and have our being is a kind of world of the diurnal sun, which is the light of the world. This otherworldness is the world of the nocturnal sun. And in Egyptian metaphysics, we begin to see that this other sun is the light within us, the soul light. That as surely as we are lighted outwardly by the sun, moon, and stars, so we are lighted inwardly by the sun which is Osiris. Now Osiris is usually, in the various manuscripts, represented seated and enthroned upon a cube rock or a perfect cube. It symbolizes the world. Very often he wears attached to the rear of his robe the tail of a lion, which is an attribute associated with the Sphinx, which suggests the androgynous nature of the deity in Egyptian thinking. His body is represented mummified. His hands, however, are free, holding the implements we have previously mentioned as he is found. Not infrequently, he is represented as black. Sometimes, however, as red. With him are his sister wives, Isis and Neptis, a symbolic of the triad of the hierarchy, which at that time consisted of Osiris, Isis, and Neptis, the great Osirian triad. The room in which he is seated is called the Hall of the Twin Truth, and it is bounded at each end by a tall column, white ornate. These two columns are the columns of the underworld, described in the Greek mystical literature. And these columns also are the columns of the porch of the temple of Solomon the King. And Osiris is therefore thrown between a black and a white column to symbolize life and death, light and darkness, reality and illusion. Osiris is furthermore thrown in Amenhotep, or in Amenti. And Amenhotep is the paradise, or the paradiso, of otherworldness. He is seated in a celestial, invisible, psychical equivalent of Egypt. In this otherworldness, the Elysian field, there is also a river Nile, flowing down slowly to the Mediterranean Sea. There is also the inundation of the Nile. And here the Egyptian in the otherworldness is leading his plow through the muddy waters by the riverbank. Here in this otherworldness are also birds singing in the rushes by the river. The papyrus plant blossoms in grandeur. And also there are lakes and streams. There are all the good things here, men who have passed the test of life, live in peace and prosperity and worship the great God. Now, this might seem a little primitive to some of us as a description of otherworldness, but it is very much more primitive than a city with four walls, with a foundation of precious stone, and gates on each side. It is not so much different. It is only a problem of how far can we penetrate into the symbolism in either case. Are we talking about something desperately literal, or are we trying to understand a mystery, as in the mystery of the city four square set forth in the Revelation of St. John? So here in the underworld, in his city four square, sits the great deity, judge of the live and the dead. And here in the crypt beneath the Egyptian temple, the great rite of the opening of the mouth was to fall. Well, we have to try to reconstruct as we can the circumstances that would lead up to the use of this ritual. We know that as set forth in the papyrus of Ani, that this must have been a strange and splendid thing. Restorations made in England at the British Museum have been able to piece together what might be termed the ritualistic content. We know that this particular ritual is dramatically suitable for theatrical production. We also know, as Professor Breasted told me in Chicago, that there are existing manuscripts, papyri, of the Book of the Coming Forth by Day, in which the prompters mark for action, and their exits and entrances are marked on the margins of the manuscript. There is no doubt it was a theatrical production. But the circumstances under which it was given, and why it was given, might still be subject to some thought. One parallel immediately suggests itself, whether it is in India, China, Egypt, Persia, Greece, or Rome. The ceremonies associated with death were always also associated with the initiation ritual. The rite for the initiation of candidates in the mystery were always rites associated with the mortuary procedure. The purpose of this was obvious to the reasonably well informed. The purpose of initiation was to carry the individual by consciousness from one world to another. This also was the inevitable function of death. Therefore, just as surely as man by initiation becomes aware of his own immortality, so by death he gains this awareness. He stands as the Egyptian said, "I am dead, yet I do not die." This is a discovery, the fact of which, apparently, is reserved for only two possible conditions. One is religious mysticism, and the other is death itself. So the mortuary ritual is always the initiation ritual. Now, when would such a ritual be used, and why? Two answers to this. First, it is quite conceivable that this pageantry would be literally portrayed in the case of the death of the pharaoh. In other words, the funerary processes in connection with the death, perhaps, of the pharaoh or his queen, or perhaps some very high officer of the household. In the case of an exceptional or extraordinary person, the ritual might be either privately or publicly performed over the actual remains of the dead. Under such conditions, the ritual would then have to be modified, because it would not be and could not be expected that the actual corpse could deliver the great negative confession of faith. Therefore, to the body would have to be associated a living attendant to speak for the body and to act as the intermediary again between the living and the dead. And this intermediary should be either Anubis or Horus himself. Therefore, there is the possibility that the ritual was given as an actual mortuary rite. There would be no reason then to doubt that an Egyptian of lesser estate who could not afford or was not entitled by the caste system of his time to any such elaborate ritual might then be interred with a manuscript copy, as was commonly talismanically done, with the idea or concept that he would then have available to him all of the passwords of the degree, all of the keys to the various gates of the divisions of the underworld, that he might know the answers and the proper deportment when he entered into the presence of the great gods in the hall of the twin chiefs. These things were therefore interred with him, along with other materials which might be of use to him. It was customary, for instance, to inter with a scribe his stylus and his writing tablet. It was not quite certain who he would write to, but at the same time, this was ceremonialism. He might feel, while resting quietly in the tomb, an irresistible desire to make a few notes. If such was the case, he must have the necessary equipment. Therefore, in your magical belief, the moment you assume that the soul has an existence apart from the body, you may assume that this soul has some continuance in living and may have, therefore, interests like or similar to those of the living person in this world. The second use of the religious ritual, as in the case of the Egyptian mystery, would be the pure problem of initiating a living person into the mysteries of the other world. This would be a ceremonial. It would be very much in the order of an ordination or a high mass performed to stimulate the spiritual power of the observer. The Egyptians definitely believed in a mnemonic system. That is, that by presenting the soul of the living person with a certain spectacle about divine matter, the soul within the person would be aroused, would leap forth in joy to behold that which was its own nature, or would hold upon the truth revealed, because these truths were already sleeping in the soul. Therefore, that through the ceremony, the sleeping truth in the soul would be awakened, and the person would have the experience of knowing the mystery behind the ritual. In either instance, then, the rite could be conceived to have been ceremonially portrayed, and the proper place for such ceremony would certainly be in the subterranean passages of the temple, or in some place isolated, or in some place of darkness away from the common convention of man, because this place must represent otherworldness. We have gradually developed in Western religion a practice or policy of placing crypts under cathedrals for the burial of the sanctified dead. The Egyptians did not follow this practice, but they also definitely did use their crypts or subterranean rooms to represent the world of the dead, a practice which we find among the Latins in the old catacombs of Rome long before the rise of Christianity. So if these rites were given, as Plutarch tells us, they were certainly given nocturnally, because they related to darkness, not by nature of evil, but by nature of hiddenness, that they related to the sun of the soul which shines in the night. And as Apuleius describes in his initiation into the mystery, he says that it was at night that he placed his foot upon the threshold of Persephone and beheld the sun shining through the earth beneath his feet. These rituals, then, were the rituals of the night sun. They were the rituals of Osiris, the mysterious deity of the subconscious. And it was in these rites that something within the subconscious experience of man was stimulated. I suspect that Egyptologists are going to have to gradually take take on and accept the psychological significance of ritualism. They're going to have to realize that this type of psychic stimulation is archetypal, and that rituals were gradually revelations of the subconscious, perhaps given at one primitive time through dreams and visions. But certainly, they have a root in the folk consciousness of man. And from this consciousness, they call forth something when they are repeated or correctly performed. So for a moment, we will attempt to restore some of this concept in the idea of the initiation, perhaps we can say, of Adi, tribe of Pharaoh. Now, we do not need to assume necessarily that Adi is dead, but in the manuscript that accompanied his mummy in the sarcophagus, this manuscript certainly implies that he has passed into the Amenta. The eschatology again comes to the forward, however. What happens to the soul of Adi, who is Osiris? Does this soul rest forever in the paradisical abode of the great God, or does it come forth again? By the time of the rise of the Osirian sect, it seems that rebirth had already invaded Egypt as a concept. And probabilities are that the eschatology in Egypt finally centers upon the idea of Palingenesis, or of the various returns, renovations, restorations of the rising of the soul from its own dead, the Greek concept of metempsychosis. So we will say that either Ani as the dead or Ani as the candidate is prepared for the ritual of the coming forth by day. If he is alive and is a neophyte to the temple, it appears that he was initiated singly, that there were no group initiations on this level, although there were what were called the orgies of the gods. And in those days, the word orgy did not have a negative implication. It merely meant ceremony. It did not mean dissipations of any kind. The tie between our present thought and the old word is ecstasis. It was the ecstasy, or the enthusiasm from entheos in God. It was a divine ecstasy. But gradually, in the Roman world, it began to be confused with the Bacchanalia, which was not its original meaning. But in any event, the candidate, accompanied by a guide appointed for this purpose, enters into the temple, is met by the priest with torches, and is led downward. Either he is led actually downward, or symbolically, the idea and concept of a descent is implied to him. I would suspect that in most cases, some form of a descent was actually made, perhaps only a few feet, perhaps 25 or 50 feet. But he was taken downward through darkness, and at various intervals along the road, he was stopped and interrogated. And because he was as yet unenlightened in these mysteries, he was vouched for and taken forward by his guide, the one that was appointed. So finally, after certain adventures and mysteries associated with symbolism, and if the temple was exceedingly well equipped, including a boat ride across a subterranean stream, and this subterranean stream might have been only a pond or pool, and possibly the boat maybe took only 3 or 4 strokes of the oar to cross it. But this was essential, because even in those days, the land of the gods was on the other shore. the river by which souls in this life are divided from the souls in the other life is the same as the river Styx in the Greek mystery, or the mysterious celestial Jordan, on whose farther shore we are to meet in everlasting bliss, according to the ancient tenets of Christianity. Having reached the other shore next now, having cast the veil of the mysteries between this world and the next, the candidate for initiation is conducted into the great hall of the Trinity, which is brilliantly lighted with candles or tapers or torches, probably originally with torches made of thongs of wood. This room was well filled, for here were gathered all of the persons involved in the great rite. Seated on the elevated throne was Osiris, probably wearing a mask of gold, and fully equipped with all of the symbols of his rank and office. He was accompanied also by Isis and Neptis, Isis wearing upon her head the empty throne to symbolize the martyrdom of her husband, and Neptis bearing upon her head the symbol of a bowl to carry consecrated water. Before the throne of Osiris, the scales of the psychostasia had been set up for the great ceremony of the weighing of the soul. The cynocephalous ape sat upon the balance of the scales. Both Hermes, Trismegistus, the recorder of the gods, with the mask with the ibis head, stood holding his stylus, the stylus and the writing tablet. Anubis, with the head of the jackal, was there. Horus was also present with the golden head of a hawk. Along one wall was gathered the 42 assessors representing the jury of the dead. There was present also Typhon, the destroyer, because in this heavenly accumulation or assembly, the spirit of negation must also be. Likewise present was Maat, the goddess of justice, represented as either blindfolded or without eyes, or wearing a mask without eyes, also wearing upon her head the ostrich plume of the law. In addition to these left presents, would also now be included Ades, who is Osiris. He comes in, raises his two hands at right angles upward, and forms the sign of the Ka, the symbol of the soul. He says, "I am a soul." And the form of his body in the ritual makes the hieroglyph to symbolize that he is unbodied, that he is a living soul that has achieved freedom from body. Now, this may mean either that he is dead, and therefore has departed from body, or that by the studies, mysticism, religion, and philosophy of the temple, he has achieved the release of his soul from the delusion of body. In any way, he speaks of the victory of the soul or life over the body by the position of his hand. He is then led forward into the presence of this assembly of the gods. And here he is presented with the negative confession of faith. In this particular case, the assessors, or the jurors, present the various articles of the negative confession. Or the herald of the court, Saint Hermes, may himself read the sacred liturgy of the question. It is said that the Egyptian was a proud man, that he would not accept a positive confession of faith. He would not end his confession by saying, "I have." He would only finish it by saying, "I have not." Therefore, the questions are all so stated that the positive answer is, "I have not." So then begins the interrogation of the soul of Osiris, who was Ammi. And in the course of interrogation, the assessors, the jurors, and the great God who reads all minds and hearts remain silent while the deceased person or the novice seeking initiation is interrogated. This interrogation is probably one of the most important ethical monuments in the philosophy of mankind, for it represents in its substance a code so extraordinarily high that it is doubtful if any person today could answer it correctly and with integrity all of these questions and assume that he had lived what they required. Also in the negative confession, we find a great many ideas of good and ill which are quite advanced, in fact, far further advanced than our own code, because this code definitely judges the individual not only by his actions, by his words, by his deeds, but by his most intimate thoughts, by his deepest convictions, by the most secret of his purposes. Also, he is judged by the very abstract motive behind the things that he has done. He is also expected to be able to state clearly that he has not been jealous of any other living being throughout life, that he has said no untrue word about any person, either in seriousness or in jest, that he has never taken from any person anything that that other person did not give freely. Now, that would be pretty tough, even in the 20th century. It's getting tougher every day, you might add. Also, we know that the Egyptian was one of the few people who listed the psychological mistakes that we make. That the negative confession infers that the individual must have conquered fear within himself. Not the fear of the known, but the fear of the unknown. That he must have transcended all doubt about universal good. That he must be free from excessive grief. That he must be free from excessive worry. That he must have in himself no negative qualities which would in any way defile the Osiris in his own soul. Well, several writers and students of the matter have come to the conclusion that the Egyptian, either living or dead, that took this examination had to, we'll say, somewhat exaggerate his virtues and perhaps overlook a few mistakes along the line. But in the ritualism, although he is honest and in the right, the candidate does admit his mistakes. He does not attempt to give all positive answers. He does not claim to be without fault. This is, in fact, part of the ritual itself. For when the confession of the faith, the confession of faith is finished, and the negative confession has been completed, there is, in all present, a certain doubt as to whether the candidate for this honor, recognition of a spiritual being, is truly justified. At that time also, the heart of the Osiris Vishwavani is placed upon one balance of the scale. And the goddess Maya takes her feather, the symbol of law, universal law, and places it on the other balance pan. if the two pans of the scale balance, if the heart is balanced with truth, if all the laws of nature balance the heart, then it is assumed that the Osiris Uwazani is true and noble. This is the final test. But in the testing, the balance is not quite perfect. And the heart of the Osiris Uwazani cries out from a little lip in the side of the jar, which is supposed to contain his mummified heart. And this voice cries out to the great god Osiris. It says, Father of all good, permit not that I shall perish with the king who ruleth for a day. Now, the king who ruleth for a day is obviously inclined or intended to represent the personality. It is the outer or personal material ego of the individual. It is this which has been weighed and tried in the balance, as the apocalypse says, and has been found wanting. Therefore, the cry of the soul goes up, but it shall not die with the king who ruleth for a day. And the assessors are very solemn. The great jurors of the dead must contemplate the virtues and vices of this soul as to whether it shall be able to enter into the blessedness of Amenhotep. And in this emergency, Horus steps forward. And Horus says, I intercede for this soul. If this soul's virtues are not entirely equal to the law, we know. But I offer myself as hostage for this soul. And if this soul shall fail, let the failure be upon me. If this soul is not worthy, let me be punished. Let my virtue be placed with the virtues of this soul upon the spirit. And with my virtues added, the balance will be made. And the god Osiris meditates upon this problem for a moment, with silence and his lofty throne, and seems not entirely convinced even then. And Horus speaks to him again and says to him, O my father, who is myself, thy son, who is thyself, asks it. To refuse me is to refuse your own heart. Therefore, there is again silence. The assessors consider the matter. And finally, the verdict is brought in. If the soul plus the love of God has made the balance, the soul is then permitted to pass into the realms of the blessed. Now, the theory is contained in the ritual that if for some reason this soul entering in is so corrupted that it cannot make the balance, and that Osiris, under these conditions, rejects the sacrifice of his own son, who offers himself as a peace offering unto the Lord. If the soul fails utterly, then Titan steps forward, the deity represented with the head of a crocodile and the body of a horse, and claims the soul. And if this soul is released to Typhon, Typhon then devours the soul and carries the soul away into darkness, where it is believed or supposed that the soul passes back into re-embodiment. or Typhon is the symbol of the mud hog of the Nile, the symbol of utter materiality. And therefore, to be swallowed up by Typhon is to be reborn in the physical world. It is now assumed, however, that the successful candidate has passed the test with the assistance of Horus. Therefore, the successful candidate approaches his father. The soul comes into the presence of the immediate light of the golden face of the sun. And Osiris holds forth the key to the world and bestows this key as a symbol of everlasting grace. And the key, of course, is the Crux Amphata, the unsated cross of Egypt, a cross with a loop for an upper bar. And when this cross is placed upon the foot of the deceased or the initiate, it is a symbol of the life bestowed, a symbol of the forgiveness of all evil, and that the candidate or the soul has been given the gift of everlasting life. Now it remains for Osiris to bestow this. For the life of everlastingness is not automatically the result of the passing ritual. The life of everlastingness must be given or awarded to the soul by Osiris. But when Osiris so does this, this Crux Amphata becomes the word of the life and the resurrection. And having been sealed with this, the soul passes triumphantly to its just reward, goes triumphantly to that better life which is its proper estate. Now it is quite understandable that a ritual of this kind would have very deep transcendental import, especially if it is something that is held and deeply believed by all who witness it. The candidate undoubtedly had been instructed in the temple prior to initiation, or the deceased Ani, the scribe of Pharaoh, was well informed in the state religion. They had passed to a certain degree of comprehension. They knew the meaning of the ritual. And we are then in the same condition almost as we might say the individual is who takes the Eucharist or the ordination of a priest. In each instance, that which is to occur is known in advance. But by some mystery of transubstantiation, these physical things become peculiarly related to metaphysical truths beyond themselves. And it is to be assumed, therefore, that the initiate, having received this mystery, was in some way internally altered, that with this faith, with this participation in the highest and most secret rites of his people, with this blessing and benediction of the Hierophant of the Mysteries, who undoubtedly impersonated Osiris, that more than a mere drama was intended. As in the elevation of the host at high mass, to the believer, there is a spiritual mystery. But this mystery bestows some alteration, some change, like the laying on of hands in the apostolic succession, that there is something by which all things are made new, by a mystery of faith itself, by a mystery of religion itself. And if these people were raised, particularly those eligible for the sacred ritual, in a philosophic atmosphere, had been educated by a system of culture in which religion was the lord over all the arts and sciences, and in which the achievement of the sanctified life was the most important of all achievements, and that as the candidate, the initiate might wait for years until the hierophant regarded him as qualified and worthy for this extraordinary honor, we cannot but doubt that in the religion in which the priest himself was the very extension of his God, where these things were really and deeply and concisely believed, that some type of profound psychological experience took place. Plato describes it, others have described it. Apuleius tells all that he dares to tell it. But according to the reports of these witnesses, at the moment of the great initiation, all these mortal elements vanished. The figure seated upon the throne with the golden mask was no longer the priest. He was Osiris. Something happened within the person accepting the ritual. Some light blazed from within himself. And as Apuleius says, all of these priestly persons were suddenly radiant. They became the very beings that they represented. Perhaps the priests themselves did not even know this. But in the heart and soul of the initiate, some kind of an internal experience occurred, by which he was no longer in the subterranean room of an ancient temple. He was in the mysterious underworld of Osiris. And in a kind of hypnotic trance or ecstasy, in the strange exhilaration of the greatest religious experience that he could conceive, this person was suddenly touched by a great cleansing, so that never again was he quite the same person. A stage had been set for him by which he is actually enabled to pass through a mystical experience. Everything was right in the psychology and chemistry of his own consciousness. And in the supreme moment of the ritual, all of the ceremonies suddenly became real. And in that instant of reality, the person lost all human dimension. He was Osiris. He was in the presence of the great psychic principle of the world. Perhaps it was in this moment of the enthronement of his own psychic center that he was aware of this experience. But someday, in the course of time, perhaps, we will understand the psychic life of man better, and we will realize that such experiences can occur, that they do not have to be delusions, that perhaps they do represent a tremendous spiritual inward realization by which things are transformed in a mystery. And in this mystery, we have the very substance of mysticism and ritualism. This, as far as we can carry it in our modern world knowledge, tells us something of the religion of the Egyptians. And I believe it tells us something of rather import, of rather psychological import to us now in our own question after the reality lie behind the shadows of appearance. In some way, the Egyptian was able to pierce this appearance through his ritual. And perhaps we will ultimately regain the understanding of this if we consider psychological research in the term of religious experience. Well, I guess our time is up, so we'll have to let it rest until next week, when we will take another group of religious rituals. I should really not say next week, because actually, I believe next Wednesday we're not meeting. Let me take another look. Someone just handed me this. I shouldn't be in any uncertainty about it. I have to just refresh my mind. Yes, next Sunday is Memorial Day. So we hope that many of you will also perhaps be in this, a little ritual of some nature, a little mysticism to tie us, perhaps it's a sacrifice that others have made to help us to have a way of life. There's something about all these rituals, pageantries, and days of solemn celebration. And perhaps if we understand one, we will understand the other. All these things are part of life as a mystery. Thank you very much.